factory set up in the film, particularly in the north side of the town. Castle Blair works here, St Margaret's works here, Robertson's, and just from around here in Robertson's. You're all aware that the house next door, which is down the Music Institute, was William Robertson's actual house, Benedict House. There's a toilet up the stair, which is well water with it. It was put in the early 1900s when one of the Prime Ministers, I'm not sure which one it was used to visit the impairment, and didn't think the toilet was up to scratch, so they put a new one in. And it is well worth a visit. And I don't mean with it loosely. Carl Moore works, Jean mentioned the Alexander Brothers, that's for the ones with the accordion, that was the ones that had the radical movement chasing them about from the impairment at the time, the 1800s. They built Carl Moore works here, which was just demolished in the last couple of years. It's supposed to become a new Tesco. Phil Muir works, and in here there's a fire station, the old fire station, the bus station used to be there. There's another Caledonian Lounge works there as well. And just like a picture from here, you had Albany works, and Albany Street was C.R. Smith is now. Further down St. Margaret Street, you had the Abbey Gardens Lounge works, and further south again, you're probably one of the biggest. Erskine Baird is just Linen Works down there, and Bottle Works as well. So I think there's about 11 massive linen factories in Dunfermline at that time. As I say, most of the buildings were still there when the flats were built, which was in the 60s, so this is set in post 1960. If you want to have a right look at them, I would do so fairly quickly because they're beginning to disappear for the developers and that sort of thing. One of the best places to see it is Founder Street. Just a wee walk in Founder Street and look at what's left here in Robertson's factory. Have a look up the wall, the stonework in the wall. You couldn't build things like that nowadays. Right. We're going now to the main topic for today. Mr. Gilbert Ray. You can see there he was born in 1841 and Penny Cook, his father was a farmer at Marston Farm. His father also had grocer shops in Edinburgh itself, and young Gilbert served his time as a grocer in Edinburgh in one of his father's shops. The family tale is that Gilbert was given £100 by his father after his time was out to go and start a good business for himself, the licensed grocer. But there must be a stipulation on that they didn't set up an opposition in Edinburgh. Entry came over here to the firm. He started in a shop in 1867 in the main gate, which was formerly owned by James Shearer. And he was only there for about a year when he started over a place in Abbey Park Place and started making aerated water. Now, aerated water at that time was fairly primitive stuff. But he started there, it soon became apparent that the place in Abbey Park Place was going to be too small for him. A year later, in addition to marrying this lady here, this is turned up in her wedding year, this is later on in life a wee bit. I just put on to show you the fashions available at that time. Married Jane Crombie. And he also moved up to premises known as Baldridge, worked in Baldridge Farm. Now they had a check up history before Gilbert Ray took them over. He just took the lease of them and didn't buy them at that time. But he built in 1830 as a flat spinning mill. The Dunfermline did about six of these flat spinning mills, and only one of them could be described, and even then, in the kind of inverted commas, as a success. Most of them folded within a very short space of time. This one only lasted 7 years, and it was then taken over by a man in the name of Robert Robertson. As a weaving concern, and he kitted it all out with the blooms and that sort of thing, but didn't take account of the fact that he had spent too much money kitting it out, he didn't have enough left to start the business up, so it lay empty again. It was then used as, or kitted out, as she said, it was never used as barracks, but it was kitted out to the government as barracks. And you heard Jean mention about the radical movement in the 1840s in Dunfermline, and occasionally they had to send for the troops. Remember that they were based in Edinburgh, and of course, it was hardly a terrible mind response if they were marching in the south
Thank you.
On the left hand side, you'll see that your depots at Falkirk and Balawa. Now, keep in mind before, keep in mind we're talking in the year of the other end is horse, the horse drawn transport. To get to Balawa, it was a round trip of 30 miles from Broad Country to Fermo. To get to Falkirk, it's even worse because you have to go around the Stirling Bridge, the broken carved bridge around it, and it's a route of 70 miles. And you had to down to a fine art because everything was made in Dunfermline and was transported to these depots for distribution around central Scotland. And the horses used to set off at 6 o'clock in the morning with a loaded car, with meat, and the car coming from Arlo or Falkirk halfway with empty bottles. Empties on it, we change over the horses and come back. So the horses look the same, they don't stable at the night. The cars were finished up all over the place. Realise that the bottle washing facility at Morgan's Works, and that's the type of bottle that's being washed. You can see them upside down there at the drainage cars. Most of these adverts say that he specialised in the cleanliness of his product and that sort of thing. You'll need to draw your own conclusion. These bottles, by the way, were outlawed in about 1905 following a court case in Dundee when a lady was drinking from the bottle and realised it was a dead mouse inside. And the reason they were now so clear, blood was eliminated. Right, where are we? As I say, we made an early recommendation for the excellence of his product. What his customers, believe it or not, is if you just have been Queen Victoria, and keep in mind that no shoes were an alcoholic product of shoes. It was eliminated. We just knew it had been eliminated. He also bottled various ales, whether it's stouts and that sort of thing. But he stopped making fermented beers right around the turn of the century. And he became very alarmed at how many of his contemporaries were falling to the wayside with an even drink. So he started moving all together. From about 1905 onwards, he only made natural money, and that's one type of thing. As I said, he was an innovator at different times, and this is maybe where he took his eye off the ball of him, and didn't make it when the Shrek's of Scotland. Different things. He made soft soap, he made rhubarb jam, he made coffee, and also made ice blocks. Slides further on, you'll see a lot of loaded with ice blocks. There were 100 made blocks. Keep in mind, this is the days before refrigerators and that sort of thing. Most of the ales or big houses had a cold room in them, and they took these blocks, and the block was just left, and the meat was hung around about it. And the block was just left to melt, took a couple of days to melt, and then drove away, sold them another crop of ice. He had 40 horses on the go at one time for horse-drawn lorries, so quite a big business. He traded as far afield as India, and keep in mind this was in the time when the British virtually ruled India, so I don't think the locals would be getting over there for many. I suspect it would be the British fearless that were out there at the time. He was his own representative. He travelled all over the UK selling his product. Keep in mind that he also was the only person that had access to his recipes for making lemonade and ginger beer and that sort of thing. So, one of the reds that used to come to the this time, obviously, the Lundy wife used a lot of sugar, and Mr. Lyle used to come and probably sort of copied him. The press wife, he always, when he went on his trails down south, he always. He always wore a top hat, top coat, a gold chain with his watch on it across his chest, and a Gladstone bag. And one of the stories was in one of the premier hotels in London, which would remain nameless, unannounced, and stayed overnight in it. And he went for his evening meal and he asked for a glass of Lay's ginger beer to go with his meal. And he was so aghast at what they charged for the glass of lemonade to go with his meal, as opposed to what he was getting for it from this hotel in London. But when he said nothing at the time, he came back up to the room and he said, the council's your account for that hotel in London. So he was that type of guy. We're now on to the bottle filling line at the Baldwin's Works about 1910. There's nobody going to tell me that that's your normal dress. The bottling line. One of the things that they say he was an inventor, he actually invented quite a number of features for the bottling line and made it much more professional than what it had been previously. And he's credited with quite a number of inventions for that. He was also an innovator. And one of the things, the power station up at Town Hill there didn't open until 1905. But 15 years before that, Gilderfrey installed electric lighting into his factory. Keep in mind it was dynamo, it was 110 volt, which was probably just as good, because his wiring apparently had no insulation on it whatsoever. But he made sure that there were 2 inches apart, the wires were 2 inches apart, and the running was 2 inches. Gives you a wee indication of it. The wires hanging all over the place. How it never went in fire, switch gear and everything like that. Very, very primitive stuff. Again, if you look at the switch here, he even wanted to put switch, written switch on this one just in case anybody was a wee bit confused about what it might be. I don't know if there is any sense of the state of the old bathroom. This is where the bottles were drained again. Just to give you the idea. The barrels were made on the premises, they had a joiner shop on the premises, and the barrels were used either for as churns for mixing the ingredients and the lemonade. They were also used, they were packed and sent, they were sent off as far afield as India, and they were shipped out to India. And they say, I had a joiner shop on the premises, not there, but this is part of the room. As you can see, they installed a miniature railway throughout the whole premises so that the bogies could be used with a push round with the empty bottle by the fuel bogies. This is a joiner shop where the crates were made for the bottles, and the barrels were all made here and repaired. And as you can see, there's at least three of the workforce taking up in that bit itself. Not a very good photograph, but a very other photograph in fact, that again it shows you. Again, this is the dispatch area, and the railway feature here. Some of these boxes, by the way, the big ones, I don't think we have two of them, but some of them have 3 dozen boxes. We was fairly fortunate in the touch is that the railway line, the siding was just on the other side of Oldham Street, and anything that was going down south could be taken by train, and it was just a case of taking it across the road and putting it in the railway van or the railway wagon over there. why he never used the railway to take his produce through to the port, but he used his own horses to take it through and load the rails. This one shows you the sort of change over time from the horses to the water transport. As I say, Portuguese horses, they bought Oscar Farm out of Gow Cordier, and they grew hay in that area. There was nothing wasted there. They used everything. And this you can see the couple of horse drawn wagons and the motor lorries over the side there. This is probably the this is one of the Rosemary's horses in the street and in Fairman. I've never been able to work with the street, maybe the year was fair to see. There's a good load on the back there, and we're all here. I think most of us are old enough to remember crates at Lemonade Pot, we've been thrown off lorries at Luck Window, we've snapped sort of thing. I know that the horse for transport would be any different. If you load a lorry, he bought these lorries, and you know, you're talking about air conditioning in the extreme. This one here is furnished to boot, and fit for that was done with gas. You know, the inch gas pipe that you get, the framework was put up with that, with a bit of back sheet over the top of it to shield the driver for the elements. I don't think it would help on greatly because there was no windscreen or anything. I mentioned about making concrete blocks. This is the block that they built for his workforce.
Glasgow, which is the site that you see studios over in the Clyde. There's no very
cars, so it's now in storage in Glasgow. And and according to the Transport Museum in Glasgow, it is without doubt the oldest motor car. So there you go, Leslie. You'll make my day if you visit. Is there a big enough door to get it in? It's still there, Ray Martin Hotel, Ray after his father, Martin was his mother's maiden name. Still there. Photograph is taken obviously not terribly long after it was built. But they got to sell more than ever. We're back to the factory again. The great one for advertising, you see that his finest stone ginger is advertised in the bonnet of the another air conditioned lorry. Even later on, this one is probably the late 20s, early 30s, and you've got invalids, raised invalids, stored up. Now, if you put citrus juice into lemonade, it was designed that you could pass it off as being a good drink for invalids. Everything was tried. This was a small booklet that they produced, probably about 1900, I think. And it gives a wee indication of the fact it's not the best one, but you can still get these on eBay. They come up every so often, and they're actually, from a historical point of view, they're worth a wee look at. This was the back of the booklet, sent out 2 dozen cases, and all the goods were carried paid, allowed to be. This is another, this is a metal plate. I think I'm asking one of these if they're delighted, but they go for about £200 now, these things. It's quite a good depiction of what the factory was like, and it gives you a fair idea of the size of the place. It's massive. We're getting up to the into about the 1960s, there was a minister, or a part of the partner minister, was making an appearance here, and you can see that the lady stand out or raised the boards instead of getting her feet wet. But you can also see that they got nowhere near being the Schweppes of Scotland. We're going to go back downhill for this thing. One of the reasons for that might have been, although I don't think it was the real reason, during the Second World War, because the shortage of sugar in the country, some of the manufacturers were curtailed to one manufacturer per area. And the filming here, both Woodrow's and Mitchell, who were competitors but much later than Gilbert Ray, were allowed to carry on, whereas Gilbert Ray and quite a few others had to abandon ship during the Second World War. Now, whoever took that rights back in government that came up with that legislation, did they take account what these firms were going to do at the end of the war when they really to start up a new business? There's most of their customers during the war, and if they really start out again. Gilbert Ray kept going, but I've got to say, stuttered along until the 70s. And you can see the sort of place it was today. Family-wise, Gilbert Ray died in 1924. His two sons, John Cromby Ray and James Ray, carried on the business. They carried it on, it's obviously not successful, they always started a business, but it wasn't as successful as it could be. And I think this photograph sums it up. If you look at this is where the dispatch where the lorries would go in to get loaded, and if you see what's holding up the conveyor, it's the old pump buttons. Some of you may remember, if you belonged in Fermin, some of you may remember that this was Gilbert Ray's, as it was, luckily. This guy might have saved it. He was Gilbert Ray's grandson, but he was killed in the Second World War. We'll be interesting story in a couple of minutes about him. He was at the high school down here, he decided he wanted to be a pilot. His father, John Ray, was very against that, and they came to a compromise that he could go through to Aberdeenshire, which is now the last airport, which is aware, and train to be an aircraft mechanic. Of course, once he got away from his father, his father died, he was no longer before he was in the pilot seat, and he became a pilot, a qualified pilot. He served the Western Isles just before the start of the Second World War. At the outbreak of war, he was working there with DOAC, and very soon after that, he was still a civilian pilot. He wasn't in the RAF or anything like that. But he was running on a run between Lucas and Stockholm in Sweden, and he was bringing back, known as the ball bearing run, he was bringing back SKF ball bearings, which were believed to be the fact that we are the best ball bearings that were made for the British war effort. He made 150 runs between Stockholm and Lucas. He was bringing back all sorts of things. It was mosquitoes that he was flying, the pilot totally unarmed, and two or three times he was trying to shot down the German aircraft, who were, strangely enough, and almost unbelievably, were driving. Sweden was neutral, of course, at that time, and the Germans were getting SKF ball bearings as well, and they were leaving the same airport. Tell the Germans where he was flying to the he was within sight of Lucas Aerodrome one morning on his way back. Weather can be seen that he was within sight, and that was the last thing he was heard of. He recovered the aircraft, and his radio operator, his body was recovered. He drove the rage, undrove the rage. I don't think he'd been interested in the lemonade road business. He wanted to be a pilot, but he was the last resort as far as that was concerned. We've got a minute for a new story before. When the Kennedy's closed in 1974, it was known that there was all sorts of, I see the old car was there, all sorts of things were left in the premises. At this time, we're down family wise to Robert Day Jr.'s two sisters, one of whom was married to a banker, and the other one was married to an architect. So the banker and the architect weren't too concerned with the lemonade. Angelo Blocco, who had the cafe in the high street next to the Regal Cinema, had just started to collect these things for some strange reason in 1974. And he tried to get into the works, but they wouldn't let him in because of health and safety, which was a strange stuff. But 2 years later, the Regal Cinema was burned to the ground, and the demolishers were in, demolishing the Regal Cinema, and they were getting a lunch at the Malocco's cafe. They just happened to mention, oh, we've got another job up in Gold Drum Street. So we just stepped up and apparently started the warning from the train here. Got into the factory, they got the keys, they got in, but they realised quickly that everything of any value was away. Noticed in the corner in one of the yards a load of broken glass, so they had a shovel with them, and the shovel threw it to see if any old gray bottles made a hole there, nothing to be found. The glass was all on top of a metal panel. He got the shovel underneath the panel and lifted it. And there was over 1,000 of these bottles, packed in ash from the boiler, stacked up like the Terracotta Warriors. Couldn't believe it. Took the 2 days to get them out, to get the bottles out. Just proves that the court case down here where the lady got the mouse in the bottle, the old lady obviously thought that all these few bottles that would come back into the fashion content or other.